Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is United Mine Workers v. Brushy Creek Coal Company. Mr. Piles.
Thank you. Your Honor, my name is Brad Piles. I represent 63 retirees of Brushy Creek Coal Company and their union, the United Mine Workers. This is a case where the basic collective bargaining agreement is the National Bituminous Coal Wage Agreements of 1993 and 1998. Brushy Creek became signatory to Memoranda of Understanding, which incorporated the terms of those agreements with certain modifications. None of those modifications makes any changes with respect to the language of the basic agreement as far as retiree benefits are concerned. There was a separate negotiated health plan, which was part of the agreement. That health plan contains a reservation of rights clause. The origin of that reservation of rights clause is that it appeared in a draft from either the employer or from the insurance company for the first time without prior discussion. It was reviewed and flagged by the union negotiators as something that they saw as inconsistent with the promise of lifetime benefits contained in the language. They objected to it, and it was changed. They added to the standard boilerplate reservation of rights clause the language subject to the collective bargaining agreement. The Sixth Circuit in the McCoy versus Meridian case examined similar language in the same situation and construed the phrase subject to the collective bargaining agreement to mean subject to everything in the collective bargaining agreement.
But you're acknowledging, aren't you, that this is ambiguous and you want a trial?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. The Sixth Circuit's interpretation of the natural reading of that language, I believe, is correct. At a minimum, it is a reasonable construction of that language. And it constrains the right of Brushy Creek to make changes that conflict with the terms of the contract. I believe that there are several provisions that it conflicts with. One is the clear promise of lifetime benefits that continue in the contract. The other is the fact that the contract contains an explicit statement of how the retiree benefits may be changed after expiration of the contract. They may be changed jointly, not unilaterally. Now
you have two classes of retirees, don't you? You have one who retired during the... You have one who are acknowledged to have retired when the agreement was enforced, but then you have people who stopped working but they hadn't started receiving benefits. Is that correct?
Well, it's a little complicated, Your Honor. Let me try to sort it out for you. At the time Brushy Creek changed the plan, which was several years after the termination of the collective bargaining agreement, they continued to provide modified benefits to those individuals who were already in the plan. Under the provisions of the National Bituminous Coal Wage Agreement, any retiree, including what they call a deferred vested pensioner, which is a retiree with 20 years of service, is entitled to benefits at age 55. There were a number of those people who became 55 between the expiration of the contract and the change.
So your view is that they're retirees within the meaning of the...
Yes, because
They're just, they're retired, but they have to, they retired early, so they have to wait for their benefits.
They have to wait for their benefits, and the there is language in the pension plan which defines when retirement occurs. And the pension plan is incorporated into the basic contract by reference, and that language says that retirement occurs on your last day of signatory service, regardless of whether you can take an immediate or a deferred pension. There was that issue came up in the Beth Energy case in West Virginia, and Judge Goodwin's analysis of that situation is correct, I believe.
And if we agreed with you and ordered a trial, what would be your best evidence that you would want to put in on the trial?
There are a number of things, Your Honor. First of all,
they asked for one.
Yeah, this is a contract between the United Mine Workers and the BCOA. Not between the United Mine Workers and Brushy Creek. Their status with respect to this contract is that of a Me Too signatory. The best evidence would be testimony from the negotiators on both sides, the Bituminous Coal Operators Association and the UMW, who would testify that, yes, indeed, their intent was to make the to continue the lifetime promise of benefits and to specifically place the obligation to provide those benefits on the signatory employer.
Have they been deposed?
They haven't been deposed. There was no discovery permitted in this case. There is a declaration in the record and excerpts from several briefs involving deadlock arbitrations over the 1993 benefit plan, which was a new benefit plan created in that situation, that set out the position of the BCOA. So there's evidence in the record. It's extrinsic evidence, obviously, at this point, but there's some evidence in the record that the BCOA's position is, in fact, the same as the UMW's position, that the Coal Act forced a decision. Because when Congress enacted the Coal Act and took care of the previous retirees, they left to future collective bargaining whether those benefits were going to continue, and if so, who's going to pay for them. And the response was the new language that was included in the 1993 agreement and has been carried forward in subsequent agreements, that says that the parties expressly agree that the language references to for life and until death that are retained in this general description. And those are the language that had been in the contract since 1974, which had been construed by numerous courts as promising vested lifetime benefits, which were the basis of Congress's enactment of the Coal Act, and the basis of the numerous courts of appeals who upheld the Coal Act on the basis that that promise of lifetime benefits took care of the due process issue as far as whether that legislation was appropriate.
The Coal Act that you're mentioning, is this different from or the same as the Black Lung Benefits Act?
No, it's different. It's an act that basically reversed the decisions in the Royal and Noble cases that placed the lifetime obligation on the 1974 benefit plan, which was originally created as a multi-employer plan covering all of the employees and retirees. When the employers negotiated for separate plans for their employees and retirees, it was retained as a fund for orphan miners whose companies were no longer in business. The Royal and Noble decisions were trying to determine whose is it the employer's responsibility after the expiration of the contract, or is it the responsibility of the orphan fund? And the courts relied on language in the contract, which really didn't...
Did you say orphan fund?
Yes.
What's that?
Well, it provides benefits for retirees of companies who are no longer in business and unable to pay.
Is this a statutory thing or private?
No, that was the 1974 benefit plan. What the
private plan.
Yeah, it was initially a private plan. The Cole Act merged that fund and the 1950 benefit plan, which was the plan that was covering retired coal miners before 1974. Yes.
And the health benefits that your clients are seeking, are these integrated with the black lung benefits, or are they?
No, they're separate. The Cole Act basically required individual employers who had gone out of business but were still able to pay to assume the financial responsibility for providing benefits to those retirees, either through having an employer benefit plan or through contributing to...
But I'm talking about the benefits you're seeking in this case.
No, they are not covered by the Cole Act. The Cole Act took care of everyone...
Black Lung Benefits Act.
No. No.
What if someone has black lung benefits, black lung disease? Does he have both his statutory entitlement and he'd get benefits under the collective bargaining agreement or what?
Yes, except there would be an offset with respect to medical treatment benefits. There's indemnity benefits basically for the disability and there's medical benefits. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Glazer?
Thank you, Your Honor. Peter Glazer for Brushy Creek Coal Company and Western Fuels, Illinois. I have to start by correcting one item in our brief that we unfortunately miscited and didn't realize until we were preparing for oral argument just yesterday. On page 15 of our brief, on the third and fourth lines from the bottom of the brief, we are quoting one of the three term of the agreement clauses that are in the national agreement that Mr. Piles was just talking about. And we said, quote, notwithstanding any other provision in this agreement. Now, that language does not appear. That's an error on our mistake, and we apologize to the court for it that we didn't pick that up before. But the rest of the quote is correct.
I was unclear from your brief whether you're going for broke here or whether you also would have extrinsic evidence if we reversed and said that the agreement was ambiguous and required extrinsic evidence to disambiguate. Do you have, because your opponent mentioned extrinsic evidence in his brief, but you didn't, so I just wondered if you had any.
No, well, our position is that the agreement's...
I know your position, but I wonder, do you have a backup, or is it your view that if we rule that the contract is ambiguous, then you would concede that their extrinsic evidence would show is the only evidence, that you don't have any extrinsic evidence?
No, Your Honor, we do have extrinsic evidence, and if we do go to trial, we are prepared to bring forward.
Okay. I just wanted to make clear what your position was on that. Yeah.
Right. Let me just start by correcting something that counsel just said when he was reciting what he said was the history of the reservation of rights clause in the plan document, the 1998 plan document that is at issue. And he said that the reservation of rights clause first appeared in the 1998 plan. That is not correct. In fact, the reservation of rights clause first appeared in the January 1st, 1994 plan, that was negotiated right after the 1993 agreement. The union themselves put that into the record, and it is the plan document is page 13.
What difference does it make?
Because that original language in the original reservation of rights language does not have the term subject to the collective bargaining agreement in it. So the union's position here has been that there's been this long history in the coal industry where everybody knows that there is vested benefits for life for these retirees, and it's been around forever and was confirmed in the Coal Act, and we got it again in the 1993 agreement. In point of fact, the 1993 agreement, as with previous agreements, always provided for individually negotiated employer plans. And the national agreement has always provided that if there is anything in the individual plans that conflicts with the national plan, the individual plans control. For that period, 1994 through 1998, because there was a completely unqualified reservation of rights clause, there were no vested benefits. There was nothing. Brushy Creek had the ability to modify or terminate benefits at any time, even during the term of the agreement, under this court's precedent. And
what,
under the,
what's the meaning of the language in the agreement having to do with joint amendments or modifications after the expiration of the agreement then?
I think that you have to read this language in context of the entire sentence. You have a sentence that has two clauses, and in the first clause it says benefits are provided for the term of the agreement only. Now, the union reads that second clause as essentially eviscerating the first clause. The union says, in essence, well, what the whole sentence...
It's just contradictory. It's not that the second eviscerates the first any more than the first eviscerated. They're just completely... I think they're just completely inconsistent. So the first one, the clause you like, says are established for the terms of this agreement only. That's very clear. But the second says may be jointly amended, and what I think is the most significant language, may be jointly amended or modified at any time after the expiration or termination of this agreement, which would be meaningless if there were no benefits that persisted after the expiration, because then what is there to amend?
I think if Your Honor understands the language that we're talking about in context, keep in mind this is in the national agreement between the BCOA and the UMWA. There are numerous members of the BCOA, and then there are also Me Too signers who adopt this in whole or in part. And this national agreement had predecessors going back decades, and barring a collapse of the industry, it would be expected that there would be additional collective bargaining after the agreement expired. But it would not have been expected that every single operator who became...
Well, you see, that sounds as if you're conceding that there's an ambiguity here, and you're explaining circumstances that would disambiguate it in your favor, which is fine. But isn't that the sort of thing one needs a trial for?
I would actually disagree with that, Your Honor. I think that there is precedent in this court in these very retiree benefit cases where the court has looked at two clauses that appear to be facially inconsistent, but before saying, well, ambiguity, we need to have a trial, the court has tried to find a sensible way of harmonizing the two clauses to figure out whether there is a way to read this clause that makes sense. So that in the basic cases where the court has had...
I don't see that in our cases. I mean, clearly, if a court is faced with an argument over a contract, yes, you try to resolve it by reading the contract. But as soon as you go outside the contract and start talking about the background, the history, the circumstances, and so on, then it seems to me you need a trial.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think that the court can discern the purpose and intent of the contract here simply by reading the contract itself and understanding what the contract is provided.
It says the benefits provided by, I'm going to leave out what I think are the unimportant words, the benefits provided by an employer may be, jointly amended, modified after the expiration of the agreement.
Well, certainly it may, and the court below, I think, correctly noted that it uses the discretionary word may.
That implies that there can be benefits after the agreement expired. Otherwise, there's nothing to modify.
Well, but that argument could also be turned around if you're assuming that benefits are guaranteed for the term of the agreement itself. Then you could always, in any event, mutually agree to modify the benefits during the term of the agreement.
No, but it says may be modified after the agreement expires. How can you modify benefits after an agreement expires unless the benefits survive the expiration?
Because the parties can anticipate that after the agreement expires, because this is a national agreement, it will be expected that there will be further negotiations. And so
it's not further negotiations. It says the benefits may be modified after the expiration. And that implies there are benefits. It's not certain, obviously, but that's what it seems to be saying.
But again, I would go back to that you're left with a sentence that, in the union's interpretation, doesn't make sense.
Your interpretation doesn't make any sense either, because you have not assigned a meaning to that second clause that assumes that benefits always die with the agreement.
But because benefits don't always die with the agreement. These agreements are extended. They stay in place during periods of time
when that's not an expiration or termination.
I understand that, Your Honor, but it is. I'm just trying to say that it is trying to recognize that there could be circumstances post-expiration. Obviously,
it's always within the power of two parties to modify their agreement or to recontract after the agreement has expired. Why would you put that in? Why would that ever be in there? Why would someone say in a contract, well, you know, after this contract expires, we may form a new contract.
But that very contract provision that you're mentioning now, in fact, does not atypically exist in contracts. You often have contracts that say that after the term of the agreement expires, the parties may mutually agree on an additional five-year term, for instance. And we as lawyers would...
You're not reading the actual sentence. The sentence doesn't say the agreement may be amended. It says the benefits may be amended or modified. Right?
That's correct. It doesn't say...
May be modified after the agreement expires. That implies that there are benefits going on after the agreement. Or at least, it's a permissible interpretation of that term,
well,
I think.
I would, just to finish up this subject, I would also point out, as we said, that there are two other contract clauses that also use the phrase for the term of the agreement. But then I would also go back to the point that we have an individually negotiated plan. And in our individually negotiated plan, which was negotiated a year and a half after, or executed a year and a half after the national plan. The parties understood when they were negotiating that plan that they had the full right.
They understood. That sounds like extrinsic evidence.
No, it's not extrinsic evidence, because the national contract itself provides for the negotiation of individual employer plans.
They understood something. They understood. You're talking about what they were thinking, not something that's on a piece of paper.
Well, I'm saying that, I'm sorry, based on the language of the contract, the parties would have known
So are you saying this language we've been talking about was amended by the individual agreement?
It was superseded by the individual agreement.
So it's not even effective.
Well,
what
we
superseded?
Our argument is
it was superseded.
What we have is a phrase in the plan termination provision that says subject to the collective bargaining agreement. The union reads that phrase, subject to the collective bargaining agreement, to basically, again, eviscerate the meaning of that plan termination provision.
Is your argument that this language we were talking about has been was superseded by your individual?
Our argument is that the reservation of rights language is consistent.
Now, just answer my question. Has this been superseded, this language?
I can only answer that by saying that if
you answer yes, then I think it's a tribal issue.
I think that what the parties were trying to get at.
I don't like that. What the parties were trying to get at? Trying to get at is the language of extrinsic evidence.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, but in reading contract language, what we are trying to do is to discern the intent of the parties. So if I'm saying what the parties were trying to get at,
answer my question, was this language superseded or not?
It was superseded to the extent that the language in the national agreement is interpreted as creating a right to vested benefits after the contract expires.
What is the language you rely on for this supersession argument?
It is the plan termination provision itself that says that the administrator may modify or terminate benefits at any time subject to the collective bargaining agreement. And we know from 1994...
Doesn't that incorporate this language we've been talking about?
But when you consider that from 94 to 98, there was no subject to the collective bargaining agreement language there. And when you consider that during that period, Brushy Creek could have modified or terminated benefits at any time, in that context, what a load of weight the union is putting on the phrase subject to the collective bargaining agreement. You go from a situation where Brushy Creek can modify or terminate at any time, even during the collective bargaining agreement, and then you say, nope, Brushy Creek can't modify or terminate ever without the union's consent. And we did this through one little clause subject to the collective bargaining agreement instead of being plain. My suggestion, or what I urge the court to find, is that the more natural reading of this clause in context is simply subject to the collective bargaining agreement means while the bargaining agreement is in effect. Once there's no collective bargaining agreement, there is no collective bargaining agreement for this reservation of rights provision to be subject to.
And so you're saying there's a period of years in which this language was not applicable to the parties. Is that what you're saying?
The subject to the collective bargaining agreement language, yes, that's correct.
Well, and therefore, what we've been talking about, the jointly amended thing, that's in the collective bargaining agreement, right?
That's in the national, yes, that's correct.
You're saying that in this four-year period, the collective bargaining agreement between your client and the union did not incorporate this. Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, did not incorporate...
This language about the jointly amended.
It was in the collective bargaining agreement, but the collective bargaining agreement also provided for individual employer plans.
Right, no. And so you're saying, I thought you were saying between 94 and 98, your collective bargaining agreement, individual collective bargaining agreement, did not incorporate this language.
Yes, in essence, that's
true. The union is arguing that after that, when the phrase subject to the collective bargaining national agreement was inserted in your agreement, all this came into play.
That's correct.
You say that's implausible.
That's correct.
But is it so implausible that we don't need a trial? Because what they're saying is, well, this was very, very important to them. And the negotiators was very important to get this language applicable to Brushy. And then it's a question, is that true, is important to them, or are you right that it was implausible to think Brushy would all of a sudden embrace lifetime benefits, right? Isn't that what it comes down to?
I think that when the union says that this was so important to us and we would never give this away, that is completely undermined by what was in the plan from 1994 to 1998. And so we are suggesting that the more logical reading of this sentence is that when they say subject to the collective bargaining agreement, they mean while the collective bargaining agreement is in force.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think we understand your argument.
Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Pyle, how much time does he have? 3 minutes.
Your Honor, let me address first the language that they have cited as being reservation of rights clauses within the collective bargaining agreement. If you read those provisions, what they say is not that the benefits will be provided during the term of the agreement, but that the benefits and benefit levels are guaranteed during the term of the agreement. The purpose of those provisions is to guarantee the negotiated level of benefits. And the origin of that was in the 1978 contract. And that's discussed in the Eastern case by the Supreme Court. It's also discussed in detail by the judge in the Noble case. What happened in that situation was that prior to 1978, there was a fixed contribution to these benefit plans. And all the benefits at that time were provided by multi-employer plans, the 1974 and the 1950 benefit plans. The funds ran out of money before the end of the contract, and the benefits were first cut and then terminated altogether. And the union in the 1978 agreement insisted upon a guarantee.
All right, let's not worry about that.
Okay.
So what Mr. Glazer was saying, so I'm looking at page 13 of your brief. So here's the critical language from 1998. The plan administrator may terminate, suspend, withdraw, et cetera, the plan subject to the collective bargaining agreement. And so what he's saying is, isn't it implausible to think that this very emphatic provision about the plan administrator's right to terminate, suspend, withdraw, etc., should be undermined by the innocent looking phrase subject to the collective bargaining agreement, which then incorporates that language which has the jointly amended in it? That's okay, so that's his principal argument, or the one that he emphasized in his oral argument. So what is your response?
Well, the union,
tail wagging the dog.
Yeah, the union obviously understands these to be vested benefits, and they insisted on the incorporation of that language because they recognized that the language without a qualification jeopardized those benefits. That's why it's in there.
The collective bargaining language is ambiguous, so they didn't really. It was kind of clumsy, wasn't it? They make it subject to a collective bargaining language which has these two contradictory sentences.
Well, they're not really contradictory, Your Honor, because if you look at it, what they're talking about in the sentence, the retiree or the benefits and benefit levels. This is similar to the guarantee clauses that I was just discussing. What they're talking about is that in the negotiated collective bargaining agreement, there is a specific level of benefits that once that's negotiated, that's locked in for the term of the agreement and can't be reduced. What they're dealing with here is the situation where there is no longer an ongoing collective bargaining arrangement. How do you protect vested benefits?
They say the benefits provided by an employer are established for the term of this agreement only. Doesn't that imply that they could cut the benefits to zero?
Well, it talks about the benefits and the benefit levels, Your Honor.
Yeah, I know, but just look at the benefits. Right?
Well,
benefits,
I mean,
established
the benefits,
by the term of this agreement. Well, it could be zero.
The benefits can be read to mean what does the plan cover, and the levels, how much does it pay, you know, for those particular services.
You're saying that they can change the levels, is that what you're saying?
Jointly.
But does it say jointly?
Well, it
says they're established for the term of this agreement.
Oh,
only.
No, they can't change them during the term of the agreement. They can change them afterwards jointly. not unilaterally like Brushy Creek did in this case.
Well, but that isn't that you're just talking, Mr. Piles, about the new contract can be whatever the parties agree to, right?
Right.
Both
right.
Sides. So is your argument that second phrase is simply a contract principle that underlies contracts, that there's a subsequent contract can always be formed?
No, this whole paragraph is specific to retirees. It's the attempt by the parties to establish who's responsible for the lifetime promise, which employer is responsible for which retiree, and how those benefits can be changed going forward. They're trying to preserve some flexibility, and the word jointly is in there to protect
that flexibility. What explain to me what you mean by preserving flexibility beyond normal contract negotiations. What flexibility do you have in a contract beyond its specific terms?
Well, if you have a vested benefit, what the parties were doing was to say that those benefits could be altered, and there may be many reasons why you would need to do that. Federal legislation, new treatments, Part D Medicare benefits. They were trying to preserve some flexibility but still protect the vested nature of the benefits, and that's why the jointly is in there.
But you're not giving any force to that word only. Established for this agreement only.
No, what I'm saying is that the benefits are fixed for the term of the agreement.
Only.
And then
that implies the benefits don't survive.
The benefit levels that are established, the particular package of benefits is negotiated and locked in for the term of the agreement. And with respect to retirees, since those benefits are vested, they continue beyond the agreement and they can be modified.
Why the word only? Because your argument is that the benefits were fixed until they were jointly amended, until...
They're fixed in the sense that they can't be changed only during the agreement. But they, there is the provision that they can be modified thereafter by joint agreement of the parties.
Okay, so you're sort of moving only. Okay, well, thank you very much to both
parties. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll mull it over.